Hi, I'm Stan Brakhage. I want to play for you some very ancient Chinese music. I've been talking about pipes, flutes, the origin of them possibly in China, at least the earliest references. And I realize I haven't played any Chinese music at all. And what I'd like to play for you is a piece that comes somewhere from 206 BC to 618 AD. The Chinese is probably the oldest music that we have that's actually written down. That is, that we know how very much how it was to be played, how it was to be sounded. We've had older traditions of music than this. And this one can really only be dated somewhere within the Han Dynasty. But one of the most interesting things to me about it is it's attributed to Lady Wang Xiang. The Chinese had a great tradition for honoring, for accepting the existence of women artists. And here is a woman composer who sings to us across such an immense length of time. She's actually a Chinese noblewoman who's out of favor with the king. And she is singing about her grief, but also I hope you'll hear within this strange kind of music to our ears the strains and pullings of that agony of her being in disfavor, but also what's made her last all this time, her incredible dignity, how she pulls herself together, the grace of her own charm and strength, which has lasted a long time. Thank you. the lady Wang Xiang of the Han Dynasty singing her grief across all these centuries to us. Music played on the pipa by Lui Chunyuan, one of the most accomplished living players of that ancient instrument. I want to contrast that with, several weeks ago read a statement on modernism by a Chinese poet. It was from a book called Modern Chinese Poetry, put together by Wai Lim Yip. The poet whose statement I read is Wang Yong. I want to read a different kind of lament that has to do with being not out of favor with the king, as was the case with Our Lady, but disfavored or estranged from the whole culture. This is a more modern theme. Variation 1 by Wang Yong. These are some roots entwined and all-pervading in the dark of my body. I am inert, easily rotten in this summer, in this summer. I plant with my own hands some poison ivy, an ivy so endearing. 2. If I rage, if in the dazzling sunlight I look hard at a fresh-cropped girl, if I hurry among crowds, I am only a heap of boring trifles, some causeless trembling. I dissect myself so unpleasantly and restring these fragments for others equally unpleasant. 3. You are only a number of tooth-marked ruts. You are only a number of crisscrossing streets that lead nowhere in windless afternoons. I always hold your pulse like a handful of cooling noises. 4. It is in your conceited generosity. It is in your low-priced superiority. It is in your luxuriant ignorance. I plant with my own hands some poison ivy. Ah, an ivy so endearing. Well, estrangement is always terribly painful. Because to be in disfavor of the king isn't really any that different than not being able to make it with the culture. I know a lot about the latter in a way because I'm a filmmaker. I don't really, I try to work with film as an art, and I don't really have any way to present that art to you. But I've made a living lecturing, and I have a lot of friends who have, and one whom I want to share with you off a tape made years ago is the filmmaker Peter Kabelke, Austrian filmmaker. His films are shown on the Monday night evening programs in the Fine Arts Building from time to time. He was raised in about the same time I was, being raised in Kansas and then Denver. He was being raised in Vienna, Austria. In order to escape being part of the Hitler Youth Program, he joined the Viennese choir boys. He had a very beautiful voice. His father's a musician. And so they managed to get him into that organization, which was then almost immediately turned into a branch of the Hitler Youth Group. So that, in fact, at the end of the war, Peter and all the other little choir boys, when the Allies were closing in on Vienna, Peter and his friends were, I always imagine them in cassocks and everything, being transported out of town as on a train, entirely trying to salvage works of art. So he made his escape from the approaching Allies as a work of art. I've always liked to tease Peter that he should do his autobiography just because he could title it, I Was a Viennese Choir Boy for Hitler. He grew up, and of course, and took all of his musical training into the field of film, not movie making like most people are used to, but making a kind of film very like a piece of music. And of all the filmmakers I know, his work really combined sound and picture the most beautifully. And what I want to share with you is a section of a tape where he's trying to convince me, who am a silent movie maker for the most part, to work with sound. He didn't convince me, but the tape section that I'm going to play for you is, I think, very thrilling. Anyway, he refers to me at the beginning. There's someone in the audience that I want to interest in sound. Peter Kabelke speaking at the University of Colorado about 10 years ago.
There is somebody in the audience here tonight whom I want to get interested in sound film. And so I'll tell something about an early sound film. What I want to say is that people already in the earliest stages of mankind were interested in making film. I mean, in doing what we do when we make a sound film. And they were not quite able to do it because only of technical lack of technical possibilities. And I will say what this is, what these people wanted to do. And this is to create a sync event, so to speak. I mean, to see something and hear something at the same time and get something out of it. It's as simple as that. And these sync events, for example, all what dance is about is such a sync event, because you have music or you have sound, and you try to fit it with your movement, with the movement of your body. And I mean, it's a completely illogical thing, and but it is so that combining visual and acoustical things is something which is a source of great joy to everybody. And now comes the interesting thing. What was the strongest light that you could have for your eyes? It's the sun, you see? It's a fascinating thing of the sun. But you cannot handle the sun. It's out of reach. So the sun has been imitated by fire, or, I mean, these early people who wanted to imitate the sun, or maybe lightning, you see? They could lightning have and the thunder at the same time. And all they ended up was then maybe in having a burning branch of a tree and a drum. And they could make the sync event like this. And I have witnessed myself a very early sound film when I was in Africa. This was after I made my Arnold Reiner film. This is the black and white film. And you have already heard now why I made this film. Because for the first time in mankind, you see, I'm able to say sun, light, and be dark, and light, and dark, and lightning comes, and so on. And I can thunder with it. Of course, I mean, limited. It's also not far from the branch and the drum, but it is, I mean, to us little things seem great things, and at least it's something. Or another difference that I could point out between me and these people who would drum is that I couldn't afford to have the same joy than they had out of, because they can dance for 7 days and and be naked and drink until they fall down, and they have their natural ecstasy. And for that, the drum may be enough. And when I made this black and white film, my situation was such that I had to be integrated in an Austrian 1950s society. I had to wear my clothes, and all I could do was go to the cinema and sit down and create myself something which would be, which I would like. And my passion was to create for myself an ecstasy, see, to make it like the old people made it, and to work the sun and the thunder, and to remain what I had to remain, because you cannot step out of what you are. So this was my motive. And then afterwards I went to Africa and I made the African film. And then I saw this Stone Age sound film, and I will tell you where it was. There were these people in a little village, indigenous, they were about Bronze Age or so. And they were preparing for an ecstasy. They had a big feast, they had to drink, and they had gotten some money. I couldn't really make out what it was. They had a sort of a treasure in a little box, and there were many tribes come together. And they were building up the whole day for the ecstasy to be reached in the night. And first they would have processions, and they would walk up and down. Then they would sing, and they would have choirs, and then they would have courage games. They would run against each other and fake assaults, and the excitement would grow and would grow and would grow. And then the sun started to sink, to go down, and the sun goes down rather rapidly in Africa. The more you come to the equator, the faster it goes. So you could really, and suddenly everybody followed the sinking sun. It was a huge sun ball, and it was a flat land, and the sun was coming down and down and down and down, and at the moment when the sun touched the horizon, just at the split second when the sun was touching the horizon, the first beat of drum was beaten, you see. And I was moved to tears, because this was the first, I mean, this is the first sound film in history, and it was, you see, it's the same, the grasp, this split second, you see what it is about. It is this desire to have the now moment, now is now.
And that, which I segued with Peter Kabelka's lecture on the first sound sync film, is actually not the drummers that he was hearing in Africa, but it's Songhe Gulu drummers from Niger, Africa, which is the closest equivalent that we could dig up to give you some sense of the feeling of it. But I might just as well have chosen a much more modern, though of course these drummers were modern living men playing in this ancient tradition in Niger, Africa, in this time. I might have chosen a piece by a modern composer, a composer of this century, which has for me the same feelings. I think before you forget the end of Peter's marvelous story, I'd like to go to a piece of music by the composer Lily Boulanger. It just astonishes me that this woman, Lily Boulanger, is not as well known, isn't really known at all. I think maybe the record that I'm playing off of this is one of the few that is still in print. It's an Everest record, a world premiere recording of the works of Lily Boulanger. And actually, under the auspices of her sister, Nadia, who's very much more famous than she is. Nadia, the sister, is famous as a teacher, and in fact she instructed almost all the mainstream of American, as well as a great deal of European symphonic music. Names such as Walter Piston, Aaron Copland, Roy Harris, Virgil Thompson, all studied with her. And she taught them principles that were really principles of aesthetics, of music, that really were created by this sister of hers, Lily, who was always frail and sickly, if you can believe that, after hearing this powerful Psalm 24 that I just played. Always frail and sickly, and in fact, did die in 1918 at the age of 24, leaving this incredible legacy. I'll be playing more of her later, but we're out of time today. So, some other time I'll play more, much more, of Lily Boulanger, who's one of my very favorite composers. ¶¶